I'd like to thank Trevor in a preliminary way on behalf of all, because I guess quite a few have got to move on for other commitments. But for those of you who can stay or are prepared to sacrifice those commitments to the gripping issues and address, Trevor is prepared to take some questions or discussion. So feel free to leave, but let me just ask you, if you're not a member of the Friends of the Library, to join, and there are some brochures at the back. There are a couple of events planned, which I'll mention very quickly. The next is by a couple of campus authors, Professor Amanda Nettlebeck and Robert Foster, on their book In the Name of the Law, William Wilshire and the Policing of the Australian Frontier, and that's on Thursday, the 25th of October, 6 for 6:30 p.m. here. And we're also cooperating on the 17th of October with the Don Dunstan Foundation, in a presentation by he's now Professor Brian Howe, who of course was Deputy Prime Minister in the Bob Hawke and Keating administrations, talking about weighing up Australian values based on his new book of that title, I think. So please join us, and we'll hope to see you all again. But for those who can stay, Trevor's willing to take some questions. So first question. Yep, here I think.
I've always thought it was true, and I don't see any reason for not thinking it was true. It meant that the British could get, only by a narrow margin actually, warning that German aircraft in certain numbers were coming towards them. And therefore they could get their aeroplanes in the air to be waiting for the enemy. And that gave them, of course, a huge advantage. Now, it's been said that the time that it took to get in the air from the radar having picked up the message was not much earlier than it took the Germans to get from, after all, they're only coming from France, to get to their target. So I don't know that radar was perhaps quite as important as it is if you imagine, oh, the Germans are coming from a long way, we've got plenty of warning. They didn't have plenty of warning, but they were warned, and I think it did work to their advantage, yes.
Yeah. If you're just following that point out, if you read Oliphant's book, or the book on Oliphant, you'll find that his laboratory at Birmingham University developed the magnetron that enabled aircraft to carry radar because of a very short wavelength, and that could pick enemy aircraft up fairly quickly when they're in the air. But actually, the development of the magnetron in Britain, and eventually it went over to the US and they produced in large numbers, and then the Germans got hold of it, was a major achievement in World War II. And of course you got the magnetron and the microwave oven at the present time.
Yeah.
But the question I'm going to ask of you, it's often been said that the main achievement of Britain after 1940 was to keep the war going until such time as the Japanese were crazy enough to bomb Pearl Harbor, then that brought in the Americans.
Well, that's a very complicated story, that, on which I haven't made up my mind, to be truthful. I mean, when were the Americans going to come in? If they were never going to come in, then Britain's situation was really fairly precarious. They could hold the Germans off, but there was no way that I can see the British ever defeating the Germans, especially as the Germans went on conquering other countries, getting huge quantities of supplies. The most they could have hoped for was a draw, which would have taken a hell of a lot out of them as well as their opponents. But what was going to bring the Americans in? Was it only the Japanese and the Germans? Let's remember that it wasn't only Japan which declared war on America. It was the Germans who also declared war on America after a gap of 4 days. So the Americans never actually declared war on anyone. And it does raise the very nice question, if the Americans had not been attacked, how would they have responded? If they'd only been attacked by Japan, would they have turned it entirely into a Pacific war? In which case, what good would that have been to the British? Or was it the fact that America was moving step by step towards a state of war, and that as Britain went down under the weight of its opponents, America's contribution went up? I mean, that's another way you can interpret 1941 and Lend-Lease. The Americans don't like the Germans, and they do like the British, so they want the British to win. But as it looks like the British are going down the gurgler, the American contribution has to get larger. So you've got this period in 1940 when the Americans are argued are fighting the war, but they're not actually declaring the war. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I think there is something there that says, well, you can interpret America's intervention in two ways, that it was purely a response to other countries going to war with it, or that it was steadily presenting itself in a war situation, though much more by sending the means of waging war to their, quote, allies, unquote, than by waging war themselves. I think there was, on Roosevelt's part, a considerable reluctance to getting American boys killed in a war if other boys were available using American weapons.
One right at the back. One right
there on the Battle of Arras.
A big pardon?
On the Battle of Arras.
1917? Or? No, just before Dunkirk. The British made an attack on Arras, and then they were either let down by the French or they were repulsed by the Germans. I'm not sure which. This is, as you will understand, the beginning of a subject, not the end of it. Maybe in 4 or 5 years I will be able to answer that one.
Yes, Trevor, you claim that the British public universally acclaimed the ascent of Churchill to the Prime Ministership.
Yes.
The only time there was ever a public opinion poll was in the election of 1945, and it was roundly defeated. In a household that I was living in at the time, Churchill's name was literally poison when he made his famous speech about fighting here, there and everywhere. The request was, and you will be on a plane to Canada while we do the fighting. But a mining household, or a million other households like it,
yes,
they were vehemently opposed to Churchill. They went on strike throughout the war. They were put in prison. They continued to strike. The production of coal was crucial to the war effort. Churchill did nothing to cultivate the support of the miners, who, of course, vilified him because you mentioned his previous actions.
Yes.
26, yeah. Before that,
yes.
South Wales.
Yes.
So he was a villain.
Yeah, I'm sure he was a villain. I'm sure lots of the people who support him knew he was a villain. But it was the villain we needed at the moment.
What I was always seeking is what was evidence. We saw the newsreels with normally Londoners.
Yes, yes.
I never witnessed him enter a mining area. I can find no record of him entering a mining area.
Well, I can't.
He would not have had any kind of a claim there.
He certainly.
This extended into all.
Yes.
Sectors of the working class, I don't know.
Yeah.
But well, the first time he went to the polls, it was, if people regard this as odd, you know, why did they suddenly withdraw their support? Did they ever actually support?
No. Well, I'm sure that if you looked at it in terms of politics, did you vote Liberal or did you vote Conservative? By 1945, everyone says, why should we vote with those bastards? They sold us out to Germany. They kept unemployment high. They gave us a terrible time. Labour's got a chance of giving us something better. But I think they were not thinking of Churchill at that moment. Oh, Winnie did a good job. Or we don't need him anymore, but he was good when we needed him. And I think, you know, you talk about the coal miners, they're going on strike because they've got the grip of the thing that the country really needs. Heaven's sake, it's about the only time the coal miners are in control of something the country must have. If you don't strike now, it's no good. No use striking it when there's coal aplenty. So, you know, this is the old industrial relations thing, isn't it? That the employers screw the workers when they've got the top hand, and the employers return the compliment when the advantage is with them. I don't think this is a comment on the war and Churchill. It's a comment on the fact that they know the bosses are doing very nicely and we'd like to do well too. And if we do well a bit at your expense, good for us. But I don't think, you know, I see that as being a slightly different issue from do we at this moment need Churchill or can you suggest anyone better? And who is suggesting anyone better? Yes.
I have a theory that Tommy Handley did a good deal more. You did invoke it.
I'm going to start singing, it's that man again.
maybe we come back to that one.
Yes.
There's several other questions.
Coming back to the decision where the attack was moved from the British airfields to London.
Yeah.
Now, I've read that there's a bit of byplay before that. There was an accidental bombing of London that had occurred, and I think it was widely known by the British to have been an accident. It was used as a pretext for a small raid on Berlin. Do you think that was a deliberate provocation in an attempt to get the Luftwaffe to shift its attack to the cities and away from the airfields where it was more dangerous?
I don't think it was deliberate, no. And I don't think it was decisive either. No. I think, well, I'm going here on an eminent British historian whose name now escapes me, but I'll think of him in a moment, who argues that there were plenty examples, plenty of evidence that the Germans were now moving to London, that their target had changed, and it wasn't just in response to something the British had done. It was a deliberate decision by the Germans that they were now going to change their target. The question is, why did they change the target? And I can't answer that at the moment.
Maybe you suggested the answer to that before, but they're technologically limited in their ability to actually attack the airfield.
What? Yeah.
Jared.
Yes, it's always interested me why, after the failure of the Battle of Britain, that Hitler committed such a vast army to the Russian army. You know, I can see he always had that in mind, but to put all his eggs in that one basket when he still had Britain still existing across the Channel seems a bit ridiculous.
He'd always meant to go to war with the Russians. I mean, they're the real scum.
Yes.
I mean, see the way the Germans conducted their war in Russia. You know, they never did that in France. They never treated the conquered people as just women to be raped and men to be shot. And I mean, the German behaviour, I mean, this is coming out, I think, in those important works on the barbarisation of war on the Eastern Front, that it's not the German army we used to know which fights war with absolute ferocity, but doesn't fight war against civilians who are not resisting. As far as Hitler's concerned, those Russian civilians, they're not wanted. You may use them as slave labour and kill them that way, or you may just kill them. But one way or another, you're going to be rid of them in a few years. This is the territory which the German people need to expand into, to have a good life. And that's what's going to become of this area. And his feeling against the Russians was racial. You know, we mustn't forget Hitler's presuppositions. He's not just a war leader who thinks, where can I conquer? He wants to remake the world in his own image. And in that image, the Russians don't have a place at all. The British do have a place. The French have a much inferior place. But the British are part of the Aryan people, although they've gone so soft that they're now a disgrace to the Aryan people. But I don't think there was ever the intention to treat the British as he was going to treat the Russians. And I think this notion that one day he was going to go to war with Russia was was strong, and Ian Kershaw argues that his calculation was that the sooner the better. That he, yeah.
We can probably take about two or three more questions, but I think this room is required within some quite short time frame. But there's one here, yeah.
Two questions. Firstly, are you intending a new project on 1940, perhaps in collaboration with Robin Carter?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
If so, could you tell us a little bit about that? And secondly...
Well, that's what I've been telling you about for the last hour, actually. And you'll gather I've still got a lot of work to do.
I was wondering if it's going to... Well, my second question really was, given that so much has been written about 1940, what sort of new perspective or new research were you going to bring into the question?
Yeah, well, that's an important question. And I guess one of the things, the intentions in this paper is to try and find out what are the interesting questions to look at. I mean, as you say, there's a lot been written, but there's a certain amount that hasn't been written. This whole business, could Halifax have succeeded? You know, that the people write as if this is a serious issue. I wish to tell them it's not a serious issue, that despite what John Robbins says, and I agree with a lot that John is telling me, but I still feel, you know, they knew they had to have a new prime minister and it was going to be Churchill or who? And nobody's got a who, so it's going to be Churchill. But anyway, that's the sort of thing, because I'm a political historian, despite this notion of me being a military historian, there's almost certainly something to be said when we get hold of the army files about how the army carried on with the French in the first half of the year. There's a topic there where you're going to get the war cabinet minutes, and that might reveal interesting things. There are a lot of files that haven't been looked at, and some of them are in hand, as it were. So I hope we'll have a story. Yeah.
Right. We count that as one.
Just briefly, sir, I'm very interested in what you had to say. I was in Britain, I was in England in 1938.
Uh-huh.
And I, at the time of the appeasement in Munich, I was only five at the time, but I have vivid recollections of huge numbers of airmen being transferred around the country in trains. And one of the things that I think we should remember about Neville Chamberlain, I think he had a lot to do with Birmingham industry.
Yes.
He was shrewd enough to develop the Air Force. He gave tremendous support during those crucial years, 1936-39-40. Second thing, I think the gentleman mentioned about the contribution of Oliver and his work in radar, very important. The third thing I'd like to say is Roosevelt was always very sympathetic to Britain, even though it was an isolationist country. I think we owe him great debt.
On that last point, I would say that I think a certain difference of opinion is developing between Wilson and Pryor, possibly based on the fact that Pryor has done more work on this, but I think his attitude to Churchill, to Roosevelt, is becoming rather more hostile than mine has always been. And I mean, I think there's what I'd say was that he really is sympathetic to Britain, but he's not damn well going to get any Americans killed from his sympathy. And in the end, that's what the British need, I'm afraid. So, but we will certainly have to look at that. Yes, I mean, I think all the things...
Last question over here.
I suspect you can answer this quickly, because I suspect that I'm pushing you beyond your time bound for study. But I'm tempted to take it up because you've already alluded to technological innovation in radar.
Yes.
A few weeks ago, we were in Bletchley Park.
Uh-huh.
And I was a child at the time, I didn't know. But so much secret work was undertaken there, which I gather remained secret from the Germans throughout the war.
Yes.
With code breaking and the innovation of computers and a whole heap of technological matters related to that field. Whether you would agree that has been somewhat underestimated in its importance, because in fact it was secret, remained secret for so long,
yeah,
that the equipment and the design were all destroyed unless the Russians get possession of this after the war was over. And I think it's only in retrospect that perhaps this can be properly assessed in its real importance. So I'd just like your comment on that.
Well, I mean, you're quite right. It was amazing how long it was before the matter got mentioned at all. And the people, like the one who wrote The Penguin, the history of the First World War, have had to rewrite the book in the light of what's come out, even though he was a Bletchley man himself. And may I point out that all the great Bletchley men were historians. If you ask what use is there to us, you know, we're just waiting for the next war. We're being kept in reserve for the following time when we'll tell you the truth about it.